Today's special episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Martha and Marley Spoon, Martha Stewart's best recipes and fresh ingredients delivered to your door. Get three free meals today when you use code HERITAGE on marleyspoon.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly culinary journey through culinary history. It's a special show. It's a timely feature that we want to talk about because Slow Food is hosting the Slow Food Nations Festival this July. Now, for those of you who aren't really familiar with Slow Food, and you should be by now, however, Slow Food is a global grassroots organization founded in 1989 to prevent the disappearance of local food cultures, traditions, counteract the rise of fast life, and combat people's dwindling interest in the food they eat and where it comes from and how our food choices affect the world around us. Since its beginning, Slow Food has grown into a global movement involving millions of people in over 160 countries. And this July, they are hosting the Slow Food Nations Festival in Denver. So we wanted to be sure that we told all our listeners about this event. It's July 14th through the 16th in Denver, Colorado, and it will explore a world of good, clean, fair food for all with tastings and interactive workshops, lectures, all kinds of different things. And today, I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun activities for everyone of the family. Today, I am fortunate to be able to talk to one of the participants in the Slow Food Nations Festival. It's historian, scholar, and chairman of Carolina Rice Gold Rice Foundation, David Shields. David was also, for many years, I think maybe still is, we'll find out in a second, the chairman of the Arc of Taste for the South for Slow Foods, which is all about finding out where the foods came from and preserving them. Welcome, David.
It's good to be here.
And are you still chairman of the Arc of Taste for the South for Slow Foods?
I am indeed. I've been in the chair for about 3 years, and I should be serving at least another, maybe two.
Well, that's great. What in particular will you be doing at this festival in July in Denver?
One of the things that I'm particularly interested in is showcasing the landrace heritage grains that have been revived in the South over the past 10 years or so. One of the things which is most precious in terms of the world traditions of food are the very earliest varieties of grain that have been developed by various cultures over thousands of years, hundreds of human generations, and have come down to the 21st century. There are numbers of these very ancient grains, and the South is home to about 20 of them that we've taken pains to bring back in numbers of instances or preserve.
Well, certainly as chairman of the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation, that would be one of them.
Yes, sure. The most famous of southern rices is one of the things that we have showcased for a long time. It was in the 19th century considered the most valuable rice in the world rice market, commanding the highest prices in Paris in the 1850s, and still an incredibly useful type of rice, particularly for one-pot meals. It has a certain starch quality which allows all other flavors to marry upon it. And so if you're making a jambalaya or a chicken bog or Hop and John. It's the ideal thing to put numbers of ingredients into.
Well, you wrote quite a bit about revival and creation of these cuisines and the ingredients that go into the cuisines in your book, Southern Provisions, The Creation and Revival of a Cuisine.
Yes, it was published about 2 years ago, and it's an attempt to show how the agriculture connects up with the cuisine, and how really fine cooking depends on a superlative system of ingredients. And one of the problems that we faced was that over the course of the 20th century, very economical sorts of foods eclipsed foods that were famous for their flavor. And so that we had all of these formula, these recipes handed down from families, from one's grandmother, but we couldn't actually reproduce the flavor that was intended in the original recipes because the Carolina gold rice or some of the other ingredients were gone.
Right.
We decided to bring them back, and chefs and consumers all over the South have been happy about that.
Right. Now, some people have written that the rice has such a painful history because it was raised, the crops were all overseen, or they were planted and harvested by slaves, that why would you want to revive something with such a painful history? Why would you want to revive a lot of these different lost foods?
Well, it's true that under the slave system, much toil was expended by bound people in the production of these of this commodity. But one of the things that you have to also consider is that that commodity forms, you know, a central place in the Gullah Geechee foodways. It's that tradition itself.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most recent and interesting of our revivals has to do with a rice that was maintained by a group of ex-slaves from the South in Trinidad. This was a upland dry culture rice, which is really significant because you don't have the problems of malaria that devil working in water impoundments that are usual for rice,
right.
And you could grow it on hillsides. In the end of the 18th century, a red bearded rice came from West Africa and was widely planted throughout the South. It was used by slaves for their own provisions and their huck patches, and was also adopted by farmers in the Piedmont of the South. And it thrived for about 100 years and then disappeared when white rice became so cheap that it just didn't pay to engage in any effort to grow rice. So why did it survive in Trinidad? Interesting story. During the War of 1812, the British Army invited slaves along the coast to join the Royal Marines to fight against their former masters. A group of the saltwater Geechee on the Georgia Islands did so, and the British, in order to get them, promised liberation and resettlement with their own land in another part of the British Empire. In 1816, the British fulfilled that promise, and these people went and settled in Trinidad and took with them all of the plants they grew on the sea islands of Georgia. When we went down there last December, we saw the red-bearded rice, which we thought was extinct, growing in the hills of South Trinidad around Princestown, and we met a farmer named John Elliott, who was a sixth-generation descendant of one of those ex-enslaved African freedom fighters on the coast of Georgia.
Wow. So that was one of the questions I was going to ask you. I know you're working with both chefs and farmers to revive some of these grains, find out the background of some of these ingredients. But with other than chefs and farmers, I mean, tell us a little bit about the process that you've used in researching the agriculture.
Well, one of the things that we had to do in order to revive the sort of systems that were being used that gave rise to these cuisines was to actually find out how the field systems work, which crops were rotated or co-cropped with other cultivars. And so we spent 3 years looking in 19th century ag journals before we made the first restorations. Huh. And this is a little bit different than the usual procedure with seed saving and finding ancient varieties. Often there's a kind of ethnobotanical serendipity. Somebody chances across a family's pole bean or an old apple, and people didn't even know it was lost, or but when they discover it, it's fine, and people sort of exchange it as a new discovery. In our case, we knew every enduring crop, field crop, co-crop, provision crop that was produced in our region, and systematically went out looking for it. We were looking for the small Carolina African runner peanut that was a sweeter peanut and had better oil quality. We're looking for Bene, the low-oil sesame that had come over from West Africa. We were looking for white grain sorghum, which was called guinea corn, which was used as a millet. So we had this entire list of items, and over the course of the past dozen years, I'd say we found in the neighborhood of 75% of the things on there.
Wow, first of all, I have to back up to let our listeners know that you are a distinguished professor at the University of South Carolina. Now, so no wonder that Southern provisions and Southern recipes are your specialty. And you know, it's interesting because when we think, and there's so much discussion today about what is American cuisine, American foods, but many people, when they think of American food or what is American cuisine, often think of these Southern dishes of as being the kind of the quintessential cuisine, if you will. And yet, as you said, that doesn't really taste like the original dishes. So finding these, you can read in novels, people will talk about the dishes they ate, and then to go and taste them, you wonder, something's a little left out, not as bright and exciting as they said. This must be very exciting for you to actually taste these ingredients.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing. Sometimes you get to taste things which instantly confirm the most extravagant claims. When I first tasted the Bradford watermelon, the legendary antebellum watermelon that was considered the greatest that ever was, that had been kept alive, interestingly enough, by the family that originally bred it, the Bradford family of Sumter, South Carolina. Huh. I tasted it in 2012, and it had this mineral quality, a super sweetness. It was just splendid. And then, of course, you face a very interesting question in a world which is increasingly buying seedless refrigerator melons. How do you bring back a 40-pound seeded picnic melon into the produce market? Well, one of the things we decided was that we wouldn't do that necessarily. What we would do is revive the old 19th century recipes, preparations that use the flavor of that Bradford watermelon, watermelon molasses, watermelon pickle, watermelon brandy, watermelon beer, which you can sell year-round and not worry about, you know, having 40-pound melons rotting on the produce stand.
But isn't that part of the fun of eating watermelon, to spit out all those seeds?
Yes, particularly if you have a brother or sister.
If you're like most Heritage Radio Network listeners, you love cooking quick, healthy meals on weeknights, but sometimes you get stuck when you don't have time for planning, shopping, and prepping. Or maybe you're short on new and interesting dinner ideas and dreading the trip to the grocery store. And who wants to haul all those bags home after a long day at work? Not me. That's why I'm so excited to share Martha and Marley Spoon with you. They send seasonal, pre-portioned ingredients and Martha Stewart's best recipes right to your door. No grocery shopping, no schlepping. You can choose from 10 healthy recipes each week and get a delicious meal on the table in 30 minutes. How does it work? Simply go to marleyspoon.com, choose your delivery day, and select your dishes. It's completely flexible, so you can skip, cancel, or change preferences anytime. And some of the dishes that I tried, and they do change their menus every week, was a teriyaki steak with grains and peanut chicken and noodles. Really delicious. Interesting ideas that I wouldn't have thought of. And everything is packaged specifically for that recipe. You'll never waste food again. And best of all, it's so easy to use, with 6 beautifully photographed steps for each 30-minute recipe. Want to try it? Go to marleyspoon.com and choose your meal plan now. On the checkout page, just type in the code HERITAGE for your 3 free meals. That's marleyspoon.com. Enter code HERITAGE. And let yourself drift. Break my grief. You have really created quite a movement for the South in, in general, in foodways and the history of them, and about finding these true ingredients for this cuisine. Now, when you say that, you know, the revival of, okay, these seeds, but then you're not really, or the rice, the grains, you know, the, whatever it is you're, you know, at that time that you're researching, but you're not really creating a new cuisine.
Well, one of the things that,
or are you?
I honestly believe is that, you know, when you have a great ingredient, you don't want to just engage in reenactor food. Its qualities are such that any experienced professional chef should be able to make the best new dishes out of them. And traditions are only valuable to the extent that they remain alive and dynamic, that they generate their own future. And one of the things that these flavors, these ingredients that are so exceptional in their quality do is supply a great old tool for the use of the modern workers in this world.
Well, and you have, I've read where you have said that regional resides in ingredients. And indeed, some of these ingredients might not grow as well or have the same taste if they're not grown in their locations, well, where they were, where they became so famous, and such. What you're looking at there, the southern areas.
So right, there is, and every region in the United States has its own matrix of distinctive ingredients. The South has just been particularly conscious of theirs, but the native seed search in the Southwest has been very vibrant in its revivals, and New England in recent years has become increasingly conscious of its wonderful heritage. The cideries of New England in particular have taken a very vanguard position in the restoration and recovery of the great cider apples and crab apples that made New England cider the byword of the nation.
That's true. That's right. And a lot of these different regions, they're all going to be represented at the Slow Food Nations Festival?
Yes. It is a truly national and indeed international gathering that will take place in Denver And the Arc of Taste, which is the slow food register of the most endangered, historically resonant, and flavorful ingredients, is a global register. It's a a kind of, I don't know, hall of fame, if you will, which draws attention to the very best. And that attention is important because a farmer can ask a premium when growing it, and a chef can say that this is, you know, made of the historically recognized thing, and people in a community can say we're using our signature watermelon or our signature cowpea in doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that a festival of this nature, or even just the book, if you join Slow Foods as a member, which I would encourage people to do, you do publish or have published books on the Arc of Taste, and I think connecting people with these farmers and with this history of foods gives them a better appreciation, certainly, for the foods that they're eating. I often talk on the show about how Americans spend too little for their weekly market basket, and they have to appreciate the better foods and pay a little bit more for them and appreciate them a little more. And
right.
Hopefully this festival will do that. You will be talking about the grains. You said, what are some of the other grains that you'll be talking about?
We will talk about every variety of grain. We'll talk about the restoration of the oat varieties, the English black oat, the black Tartarian oat, the naked oat, and the white potato oat, the four classic oats. Also, maybe the Virginia gray turf oat, which is a very interesting oat. It was originally bred in the colonial period for horses, and it was really, really high protein. It was sort of like horse rocket fuel, and there's no reason why human beings can't eat it. And if you really want a morning energy pickup, I mean, having a bowl of Virginia turf oats might be the equivalent of downing a six-pack of Red Bull or something like that.
You might be on to something. Who knew there were so many of those oats? But it's interesting, you mentioned something that was raised as for horse feed. And something interesting from your book, Southern Provisions, are you in talking about, you know, trying to find out the history of some of these things. And my question to you is, you said you had to figure out which of these varieties were used for fodder or for cuisines and you know, human consumption, and which of them were just planted as cover crops to regenerate the soil. So that, I mean, where do you go back that far to find it?
I usually go back to the 18th century when the field systems get established. But one of the things you discover is, you know, new varieties are always being bred into existence or introduced from elsewhere during the course of the passing decades. And it's interesting to see how a new introduction of a vegetable or a grain actually alters the landscape. One of the things that is so interesting when you take a kind of agricultural viewpoint, you realize that a lot of the root vegetables were multi-use things on the farm. They were meant for human consumption, but they were primarily there for winter feed for livestock. And you run across the most interesting sorts of comments, like in the 19th century, the carrot was not much liked by most people. It was used in stews and things like that primarily, but it was grown everywhere because horses loved them. One of the things that happens is that in the 1890s, the adherents of the physical culture movement embraced the carrot as health food, and you would have pureed carrot juice as thing next to orange juice, which would galvanize your vital spirits. So you have these cultural movements revalue vegetables over the course of the various decades.
Well, it's certainly an intriguing topic, and I did enjoy learning about the southern provisions a lot from your book, and I look forward to all of the information that comes out of these research topics, and I know that you are working with quite a few people who are in the news as well. One of the chefs, Sean Brock, has been on the show many times, and not my show, but on the network, and a few of the other agricultural people, and I think it's just such a wonderful group to bring all these people together and find out what everyone, you know, can learn and from one another and know.
One of the things that I would recommend that everyone do is that the Slow Food maintains a website of all of the ingredients on the Arc of Taste, and with a few clicks of the keyboard, you can get there and find out the stories of some remarkable ingredients.
At slowfood.org?
That's right.
Slowfood.org, and you can learn more, and you even have an opportunity to become a member, just like you have an opportunity to become a member of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We bring you all these great stories. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your information about your work, your research, and about the Slow Food Taste of Nations Festival that's coming up, remember, in July, the 14th to the 16th in Denver, Colorado. Thanks so much for listening.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.